Welcome to Talk Nation Radio and our special on the international banking system.
If the banks themselves are frozen out of issuing loans, why not let a state bank free up credit? It really is only numbers on a screen. Our entire money system is only legal agreement between parties.
We spent an hour on the phone with crack researcher and author Ellen Hodgson Brown. This week, part one of our discussion of her book, Web of Debt, copywritten in 2007 as a creative analysis of the U.S. Federal Reserve, the so-called money trust, and the fragile global economy. Ellen Brown has also been writing about the current economic collapse, something her book predicted, and you can find her ongoing analysis at the blog webofdebt.com. Her articles on global finance and how to repair America's banking system can also be found at globalresearch.ca. Ellen Brown, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Oh, thanks.
So first, what's wrong with the major U.S. banks? Just tell us the basics, you know, what derivatives are and maybe why our money is worth less and less than the value of the dollar used to be.
There's a fundamental flaw in our whole monetary system, which is that all of our money consists of debt to private banks. It's all created privately by banks. Most people think that money is created by the government. The only money the government creates are coins. The Constitution says Congress shall have the power to coin money, and that's all that Congress does. And those compose only 1/10,000th of the money supply. So all of the rest is created when a bank makes a loan, including Federal Reserve notes, which are issued by the Federal Reserve, a private banking corporation owned by many banks, which prints Federal Reserve notes and lends them to the U.S. government, or more often doesn't even print them, it just writes them into an account, which is what all banks do. When you go to a bank to get a loan, they write your promise to pay on one side as their balance sheet, as an asset to themselves, and then they write it as a liability to themselves on the other side because they're going to let you draw checks on that number in your account. So it's all done with numbers and balance sheets and double entry bookkeeping. So the fundamental flaw or problem is that banks create the principal, but they don't create the interest. So there is always more money owed back than even exists. Somebody somewhere has to be taking out a new loan just to create the interest to service the principal that is our money supply. And when people don't take out loans, when the banks are unable to make loans, for instance, as now because their books got screwed up, then the money supply shrinks and collapses. So we just don't have the money right now. It's not out there to fund a normal business. So the derivatives problem came in because this whole scheme has gone on for 300 years, ever since the Bank of England started the private central banking system. It's gone around the world, and they pretty much indebted everyone now. The third world got fully loaned up, and then they came back to us, the American consumers, as the borrowers of last resort. And then they locked in all the prime borrowers, the people that could afford to pay on their mortgages. And then they went to the subprime people, the people that should never have gotten mortgages, and they completely eliminated lending standards. So anybody who walked in the door could get a loan, and in order to get those loans off their books, because, of course, the banks didn't really want those risky loans, they sold them off to investors, mortgage-backed securities, and in order to get the investors to buy them, they protected them with a form of derivative called a credit default swap, which turned out to be no protection at all. It was merely a form of gambling. They sold the risk to yet another set of investors who might have been, I mean, they're all just ordinary people not really knowing what's going on. They would sell them, for instance, to pension funds that pension funds want to make 10% a year so they can meet their commitments. And with bond rates so low, they have to get into the risky things. So then they buy some of these, or they sell some of these credit default swaps, not even knowing what they're doing. So the whole thing is designed to keep borrowing going, but we've just run out of borrowers. That's the fundamental mathematical flaw. Maybe that's more than you wanted to know.
Well, no, not at all. And I was just wondering about the term itself, derivatives. Are we sort of saying that this is our money twice removed? In other words, as we give real money, capital, anywhere in any direction, that's consumed into this system of bankers who own the capital. whereas any debt in the world is what becomes what's represented to us as our quote-unquote banking system. Is that a fair description?
Debt is money, and money is debt. But what derivatives are, where they got the word from, is it's a form of investment that's derived from something else. In other words, you don't have to own the thing. It's like going to the racetrack and betting on the horses. You don't have to own the horse. So derivatives got to be a very popular form of trading just for that reason. It's sheer and utter gambling, and it's twice removed. So it's like going to Las Vegas, and you see the people betting down below with their own money, but you're betting on which of the bettors is going to win. Or in the case of credit default swaps, what they were, AIG, you know, was a big seller of credit default swaps. That's where they got into trouble. AIG is an insurance company, but they didn't call this insurance. They called them derivatives or credit default swaps, which meant they didn't have to set aside reserves like they normally do for insurance. And they didn't, and that's where the whole problem is now. But because they didn't have to set aside reserves, they could sell just huge amounts of these things. They collected premiums in return for promising to make the buyer whole if there was default. Well, these are in these securities that are full of subprime loans. The theory was that housing never goes down, and that's why when AIG first started doing this, they thought they were just getting free money, that they were just collecting premiums. I read that in 1998 when they first got into it, that they thought they would just be collecting premiums, but housing never goes down, and therefore it was a sure bet and what could go wrong. But of course, like anything, and especially at the exponential rate at which it was going, housing had to turn at some point, and it did. And then when it did, all these people came to collect on their bets, and of course AIG didn't have it, so they had to declare bankruptcy, or would have, except that the U.S. government stepped in and bailed them out.
Ellen Brown, are you saying AIG executives were under the impression that the mortgage industry would provide them with a fail-safe system? I mean, much in the same way that, you know, Americans assume that the Federal Reserve backs our banking system, our dollar, so that they can't fail.
They thought they were okay because they thought that real estate would never go down. Or, I mean, they must have known that at some point it would go down. But in the meantime, they were collecting these huge premiums, and they may have thought that the government would step in. I don't think they really thought it would turn in the way that it did. I mean, if you insure houses in a city and one burns down, well, you can cover that with the money from all the other houses, all the premiums you get from the other houses. But in this case, the whole town burned down because all the subprimes are going bad at the same time. Far more than they could pay. I mean, it was a mathematical flaw in their system, but anyone with any sense could have, I mean, there had to have been greed and some sense of this could end badly, but we'll be out of it, and, you know, we'll just pull out and go off with our bonuses and retire somewhere.
So there was never anything tangible, real, of value backing any of this. They were all gambling, really, on the idea that success was what they owned, America's longstanding record of success?
Well, they're just gambling. I mean, of course, there's real estate backing the securities. I mean, that's what the securities are, mortgage-backed securities. They own a bunch of mortgages, and they chop them up, and they sell them off to investors. So the investors technically are getting income from these securities, and the income stream is the people paying on their mortgages, and most people are still paying on their mortgages. So in that sense, the securities still have value, although they're not as valuable as they were. But what isn't backed was the credit default swaps. See, they sold off the risk. And all this is actually done to avoid a rule imposed by the Bank for International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland, the private head of the private central banking system, that says the banks have to have a certain amount of capital in order to make loans. And different loans are risk-weighted differently. So by selling off the risk of these loans, the banks could say, well, these loans are still technically ours, but they're not risky because we sold the loans off to somebody that was willing to sell us a credit default swap, AIG, in other words, or hedge funds. You know, a lot of hedge funds did it. Bear Stearns had those two hedge funds that got in trouble for that. That was the beginning of the end, you know, in the summer of 2007. See, it's a whole different market that's built on top of the real estate market. This credit default swap market, or the derivative market in general, is, I mean, derivatives are bets on anything. You can bet on the price of tea in China. You can bet on interest rates going up and down, or the value of different currencies relative to each other. So a huge amount of betting is going on, according to the Bank for International Settlements. Over $250 billion in derivatives trades occurred in the last year. Well, that's an impossible number. There's only $60 trillion in the whole world economy. So,
you said that this statement was made by AIG about what they thought they were doing back in the 90s. Who tricked them, or who convinced them that they were doing something other than what they thought they were?
Well, I just read an article about how they got into, they should have stuck with insurance. They were fine as long as they were insuring cars and houses from being burned down. But they got into these credit default swaps, and there was some man that worked there, and he laid the proposal out, and he said, look, all we're doing is selling premiums against default, and the odds of there being a widespread default is just, you know, it's not going to happen because housing always goes up, and it's just a sure bet here. Which it obviously wasn't. It's called the black swan event, the thing that nobody anticipated, or the chance that was so remote that it wasn't going to happen, but of course then it did happen, and that's what brought the whole thing down. But anybody with any sense could have seen it had to happen. I mean, every bubble is like that. Going back to the tulip mania in Holland, where all these Ponzi schemes, you always think when you're in it that it's going up, 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 and your friends are doing it, and you better jump in. Or even when housing was going up, I'm sure you heard that, you better buy it now because it's going to be more later, and you can always turn around and sell it for more. But any logical thinking person knows that that can't go on forever.
One of the interesting quotes on your blog, Web of Debt, is from Dennis Kucinich, who explains, Federal Reserve is no more federal than Federal Express. Now, you've said Congress has no authority over the Fed, the Federal Reserve. What is the Federal Reserve? Who owns it? What should we know about it?
The Federal Reserve is owned by many banks. There are 12 Federal Reserve branches, and each one is owned by the banks in its area. So the New York Fed, for instance, is owned by, I think, about 200 banks. And they bought stock in it originally, and they all get 6% guaranteed return interest every year. So even though the Fed claims to be nonprofit, obviously all the investors or all the people who own it are making money. Plus, the Fed funds all those banks. So it's sort of a private club. It was set up in 1913 to backstop bank runs. Well, the reason there were bank runs was that the banks did not have the money. They never had the money. The whole banking system is based on this inherent fraud called fractional reserve lending. Back in the 17th century, the goldsmiths discovered, when they started issuing banknotes for their gold, they discovered that people only came for their gold 10% of the time, so they could lend 10 times as many banknotes as they actually had gold, on average. So the whole system is still working like that. That's called fractional reserve lending, meaning you only have a fraction of the money that you're pretending to have when you lend all this stuff. So naturally, all through the 19th century, when the system was based on gold, periodically people would get suspicious and they would all come for their gold at once, and the banks wouldn't have the gold and they'd have to close their doors and there'd be a big depression and the money supply would collapse, et cetera. There'd be these big bank panics. So there was a particularly big bank panic in 1907, and J.P. Morgan supposedly saved the day, although there's evidence he actually created the bank panic. And his faction persuaded Congress to pass this Federal Reserve Act, which would backstop future bank runs. They would come up with money. Well, it obviously didn't work because the biggest bank run in history occurred in 1933, and that's when the dollar went off the gold standard. And since then, what they've done is that whenever things start to contract, they just print and print and print more money. So you're right in the sense that because the Federal Reserve can print dollars, the U.S. government will never default on its debt like other countries do because we owe the debt in dollars. So we can always just print the dollars. I mean, there's a question of hyperinflation, but we won't run out of dollars. That's my whole argument, is that this should be a public entity. And if it were a public entity, you would be covered because it really is only numbers on a screen. Our entire money system is only legal agreements between parties. It's just agreements to pay later when you don't have the money now. It's a trust. And for that, you need something akin to the judiciary, a court system that oversees these agreements. Basically, what a bank does is the seller wants his money now. The buyer doesn't have it. The buyer says, trust me, and I'll pay you over time, and I'll pay you extra for the privilege of doing that. But the grocer or whatever, the seller doesn't necessarily know the buyer and doesn't necessarily trust him. But they will trust the bank, this third-party guarantor. So what the bank does basically is guarantee this agreement. The bank says, well, we'll pretend to have the money, and we'll let you write checks on an account, and whenever we actually have to come up with the cash, we'll either get it or we'll get it from the Federal Reserve overnight or whatever, borrow it from other banks. So we'll manage to come up with the cash 10% of the time, which is about all we have to do. And then you can write checks and you pay us double over the course of the loan on average for taking that risk. But the system just hasn't worked out because the banks don't have enough reserves. They've frozen their whole capital base because they've gotten into this mess with the derivatives. And well, that's a whole other issue. That it's mark to market. You've probably heard of that. But the Bank for International Settlements under Basel II in 2004 now is requiring the banks to mark their assets to market, which means that, like these collateralized debt obligations that nobody wants, if they have a bunch of those on their books and they were counting those as assets against which they could make loans, if somebody else somewhere in some other bank tried to sell them and nobody would buy them, then the market price for them is zero, and therefore they don't get to count those in their capital. Well, that is pretty much their capital, and they really are good assets, even though there's not a present market value, because they include mortgages, which are paying income over time. Most of the people are paying, even if some of them aren't. So it's really the fault of the Bank for International Settlements, but they're not backing down. If you want to get conspiratorial about it, there is a theory going around that their intent is to bring down the whole system, because, you know, they want a global currency issued privately from Europe.
Who would we be talking about? I mean, I know there was this big controversy over the EU and their decision to go to euros in that part of the world. So are we looking at people involved in the euro, the creation of the euro, or who are we talking about here?
The Bank for International Settlements is headed in Basel, Switzerland, and there are 55 banks in it. But there's an inner core, and within that, there's an even more inner core. The basic inner core is the whole scheme goes back to the Rothschilds of the 18th century, when Amschel Rothschild said, allow me to issue and control a nation's money, and I care not who makes its laws. That's what they're after. If you read about the Bank for International Settlements, this isn't actually a conspiracy theory. It's actually what they are aiming for, is to issue the money privately of the world. But see, the problem with that, I mean, I agree that we need some sort of international standards, but you don't want a central bank somewhere in Europe having the power to issue all of our money and having control over who gets it and who doesn't. It would be like a super Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve would be fine if it actually were federal. We need a system like that. We need a credit system, and the U.S. government is the natural deep pocket to step up and say, we acknowledge, you know, this person has been paid, and we acknowledge that that dollar is good, and it's good for X amount of value, and there should be a big public credit system like the Federal Reserve and like the bank. The problem is that if they're run and owned privately, then all the profits get taken off the top privately, and it's just mathematically, it doesn't work mathematically. It only would work mathematically if the profits go back to the public, and if the public has the power to issue some extra money to cover the interest, et cetera. I have that all detailed in my book.
The SNL scandal. What people tended to do during that crisis was say, well, gee, what if this were on a national proportion, you know? But it happened in a smaller sense because these were savings and loan banks. But it was the skimming of all the profit. It was the taking of all the capital off the top, right?
Mm-hmm. A perfect model, historically. You know, all through the 18th century, the American colonists issued their own money. There have been two competing monetary systems vying for dominance for 300 years. One is the privately issued money of the central banking system started by the Bank of England, and the other is publicly issued money, which goes back to the American colonists, a brilliant invention where local governments issued paper script in the 18th century, which were basically receipts acknowledging that something had been given to the government. So, for instance, you would pay your employees with these paper receipts acknowledging work delivered, and then they could go out and trade the receipts for other things in the community. It's a form of a community currency, really. It's where the community acknowledges that value has been given to the community, and the community gives back. So where that system worked particularly well, some governments would just print and print, like Massachusetts, and they got in trouble for that because it was hyperinflationary. But the perfect system was in Pennsylvania. That was Benjamin Franklin's colony, and he wrote about it and raved about it and was called the father of paper money. In Pennsylvania, the provincial government owned a bank called the Land Bank, supposedly backed by land, but land really didn't have anything to do with it. So the bank would issue the money, the paper scrip, and it would lend it to farmers at 5% interest. So then all the money would come back to the bank. And then to cover the interest, the bank, being the government, had the power to issue some extra. So let's say that you would print $105. You would lend $100 to the farmers at 5% interest, and then you would spend the other $5 to pay your employees or build roads and bridges or whatever people need, you know, whatever the government did on the government's budget. And then you would have $105 circulating in the economy, and it would all come back as principal and interest. So it was totally self-contained. You only had to do it once. You could then lend the same $100 over again and print the same five or whatever you needed to adjust it to the needs of the economy. So during the time that system was in place, Pennsylvanians paid no taxes. They had no government debt, and prices did not inflate. It was a perfect, very sound system. People were, before that, nobody wanted to go to Pennsylvania because they didn't have any money. They didn't have gold, and they had to borrow it from the bankers, the British bankers, at high interest rates. So then after they put this system in place, everybody was flooding in and the economy was booming, and you know, there was a turkey in every pot or whatever they said.
When you're talking about the Bank of International Settlements, what Americans might we know about, or who has any kind of power and influence within that level of bankers in the world?
We always send a representative. Originally, we would not join the Bank for International Settlements because it was Hitler's bank. So for years, America declined to join, but I think we did send a representative. And the Bank for International Settlements laid low. It was kind of secret. But then at some point, they decided they wanted a building, so they built a nice big building, and they sort of came out. I think that was maybe in the 60s. It is in Switzerland. My daughter lives in Basel, Switzerland, a couple of blocks from it, so I've seen it. It's quite imposing. It's sort of a fort unto itself. They don't pay taxes. They have their own police force. And, you know, they're pretty much an independent power.
Sounds like the Vatican with diplomatic immunity.
They're very like, they do have immunity, yeah.
And so there's been a news story recently that the banks of Switzerland need to disclose what they have. Why is that relevant, or is that relevant?
Well, I think people were using Switzerland as a safe haven. I mean, there are a number of places that people manage to hide their assets and not pay taxes and so forth. So they're trying to make that more public, which is good.
But so now, just finally, this Bank of International Settlements, a lot of wealthy people must know about it, right?
Well, people have certainly heard of the Bank for International Settlements, but it does keep a low profile. But now you hear a lot of people, on CNBC, they talk about the mark-to-market rule and how that's messed everything up, and that it's not, it's assuming that, well, banks trade in bonds, which are loans, and they're not really intended to be instantly marketable like stocks. It's like if you bought stock in a private corporation that hadn't gone public, you probably can't find any buyer for your stock. That's the advantage of this whole public market, that you have an instant buyer all the time, so you have an instant price. So their argument is it's not fair to value bank assets, which are in the nature of loans, as if they were a form of stock that has a daily value, or gold or something where you can track the value every day. So the Bank for International Settlements should back off on that standard, but they haven't done it. It's definitely been in the news lately, but they don't talk about, you know, any ultimate designs. You have to go to the internet news for that, but that's around too if you can find that.
You write that the state of North Dakota has the only state-owned bank in the union. Therefore, is the state of North Dakota solvent?
It is. It's one of four banks that are solvent. In fact, it has a surplus of $1.2 billion, which is a lot of money, you know, for a small state like that. And they have a very vibrant student loan program, lots of money for loans. And they make loans to farmers at 1%, and they don't foreclose very often. I mean, they're very lenient, and they work things out. So here's the secret of their success. They, by law, well, these are a bunch of farmers in 1919 who were, they're Scandinavians who were up there in that cold place trying to meet their harvesting in the frost, and all their money was going to the Wall Street bankers and the railroad men. So the money was leaving the state. So to keep the money within the state, they passed legislation. They got together in a group called the Nonpartisan League, which I thought was great. You know, it's above politics. They just want to keep their money in the state. So they agitated and got legislation passed that all the state's revenues would go into a bank owned by the state, the Bank of North Dakota. And then the bank operates just like any other bank. In other words, it can then take those revenues and fan them into 10 times that sum in loans, or actually more now. And because the bank is owned by the state has control over how it sets its policies. So, for instance, it can make these 1% loans to farmers. In theory, what it could make 0% loans to itself to do state projects like roads and bridges and all those things that need to be, all that infrastructure that needs to be rebuilt, or self-sustaining projects like low-cost housing that would pay rents and that would then go back and pay off the loan. So you would have 0% financing, let's say, to build low-cost housing. And then the rents would come back and pay off the loan. So it's not inflationary. You pay the loan off, but you don't have to pay more than the thing costs. So if you cut out interest, now states are paying huge amounts of interest, and that's why they're bankrupt, because of this whole credit freeze. If you eliminated interest from the cost of state projects, you would reduce the cost on average in half. That was according to some German woman that figured out all this data. So things that look like they're not affordable or not sustainable would be sustainable, like alternative energy or, you know, low-cost housing. What are we going to do with all these homeless? I think it's unconscionable that we in California have this whole homeless sort of shanty town outside Sacramento of people that have been put out of their homes. I mean, we must be able to fund housing for those people. So the reason we can't is interest is so, I mean, they can't get the loans to fund it because they're technically bankrupt. But if you owned your own bank, you could issue 0% loans to yourself, build all this stuff, pay your workers, pay your employees, and you could charge something for rent, and the thing would pay for itself over time. Another way to look at it is that it's called accrual accounting, where you count the asset as if it was already there, although it hasn't been built yet. So the asset goes on one side of your books, and then the money goes on the other side, and then you draw on these numbers that you created in an account, you draw on those to pay for the asset. So the money, instead of having to have the money first, the money is created as the project is created. They come in existence together. Money really just reflects goods and services. That's the real measure of money, is the thing that goes in to develop these goods and services.
Ellen Hodgson Brown is author of Web of Debt, and you can find her online at webofdebt.com. In our next half hour with Ellen Brown, we'll hear more on how legislators can set up state banks and why they should, plus more on Wall Street investing.
I'm starting to feel a little, actually, possibly bullish myself, although, of course, I'm totally into gold and silver and all those contrarian-type investments. I mean, I think you can't really go wrong with gold.
For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. This program is produced at the studios of WHUS at the University of Connecticut in Storrs, Connecticut. WHUS.org to listen live Wednesdays at 5 p.m., TalkNationRadio.org for transcripts, audio, and discussions.